Support for Eurosceptic political parties continues to rise across Europe. Although in many European countries support for the EU has gone up, Eurosceptic parties are increasingly successful. More than 1 in 3 Europeans now vote for a Eurosceptic party, according to research by the University of Amsterdam. Today, about 30% of Europeans vote for populists and 15% vote for far-right parties. What is Euroscepticism? And is Euroscepticism a security issue?
Hello everyone, and welcome to a global perspective on European politics. My name is Aga Bayramov.
And my name is Tom Wagenmakers, and we are lecturers in international relations at the University of Groningen.
You are listening to our very first episode, and today our topic is Euroscepticism and security. It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Jaap de Wilde, Chair of International Relations and Security Studies Group at the University of Groningen, and Professor Jan van der Harst, Chair of History and Theory of European Integration at the University of Groningen. Jaap, Jan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much. So first, I have a question for Jan. As you know, and as you mentioned in your articles, since the early 2000s, Euroscepticism has undergone a substantial increase in support, especially among political parties and the public at large. But what exactly is Euroscepticism and how would you define it? And then as a follow-up question, is Euroscepticism specifically against the European Union or is it against cooperation in general?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for this question and for interviewing me here. Concerning Euroscepticism, yeah, it's a bit of a difficult term because it could be broadly explained. In general, one would say that Euroscepticism is criticism of the EU and of the process of European integration. But it needs a bit more refinement, I think, because there are a lot of Euroscepticists of different categories. So you could make a distinction between soft Euroscepticism and hard Euroscepticism. With soft Euroscepticism, we mean those people who are against certain policies or certain institutions of the EU. And they seek reform, so they want to reform the European Union. Whereas hard Euroscepticists reject the European Union outright, and they would be in favor of leaving the EU. So I think it's important to make this distinction. Concerning your other question about is it particularly concerning the EU? Your skepticism, I would say yes. I think it's very much directed against the EU, just for the reason that the EU is the most important institution in terms of European integration. I googled yesterday Council of Europe and Euroscepticism, and you don't get any hit there. Council of Europe is an institution in Strasbourg, which is mainly concerned with human rights issues. So this is not an institution where Euroscepticism would be aimed at. So I would say it particularly concerns the EU.
And I also want to follow up with the soft and the hard Euroscepticism because it's really interesting division. Do you have a particular example, maybe specific parties that falls under the soft Euroscepticism and those under the hard skepticism? For example, in the Netherlands, would you see those soft and hard skeptics parties?
Yeah, sure. For example, a soft Euroscepticist party would be the Socialist Party, for example, the Christian Union, maybe. Hard Euroscepticist parties are Geert Wilders, the PVV, the Freedom Party, and Forum for Democracy of Thierry Baudet. And also in Europe, you could make distinctions, for example, the AfD, the Alternatief voor Duitsland, could be considered nowadays at least a hard Euroscepticist party. In the past, it was a soft Euroscepticist party because it started as a party which was against the euro, but not particularly against European integration because they sought reform. They thought that the EU was reformable. So also the AfD nowadays, they in their new party program for the next elections in September, they say that they want to leave the European Union, so that there should be a Dexit, Germany leaving the European Union. Whereas parties like many Eastern European parties, actually, including Fidesz and PIS, Fidesz in Hungary and PIS in Poland, but also the Rassemblement National in France, they could be considered more soft Euroscepticists because they want to change the European Union as it is. They they seek reform within the European Union.
All right, I have another question regarding the soft and hard Eurosceptic parties. Why is there in the media mostly a focus on the right-wing Eurosceptic parties and not necessarily on the left-wing Eurosceptic parties?
Well, that's nowadays, because in the past, I think, for example, if you look to the Netherlands, Euroscepticism is a long-time phenomenon already. Everybody thinks that it started in the 2000s, but it was already there in the 1950s, 1960s, although the parties were small at that time. Were Euroscepticists, but these were mostly left-wing Euroscepticist parties at the time, like the Communist Party and the Pacifist Party in the Netherlands. But in more recent times, it changed to indeed to a focus on right-wing Euroscepticism, social-cultural Euroscepticism, parties who focus on retaining the national values, aversion to migration, and so on and so forth. And why is it that the media focuses so much on it? I think it has to do with the fact that they are just most vocal. They're very vocal. They're also very successful sometimes because they attract a lot of public, a lot of voters, and they're very outspoken in their opinions. And the media, I think, are very interested in hearing these extreme or reflecting these extreme views. So that's why they get more attention at the moment than the soft Euroscepticists.
Okay, thank you so much, Jan, especially for this division as well. And as a follow-up, I want to ask Jaap, what is your opinion about this soft and hard Euroscepticism, and especially within the Netherlands? Maybe it's not, of course, your expertise party division in Europe, not Europe, but in the Netherlands. There is a party, interesting party, when I learn about this, Party for Dieren, a party for animals. I realize that it's also one of the Eurosceptic parties. But overall, very interesting. Like, what's your opinion about Eurosceptic parties? And do you view them as an expert on security against cooperation and European integration, or is just a weak populist parties?
Well, it's difficult to really make that distinction always. I think it's very telling that also the parties that are skeptical of the EU are seeking cooperation with each other to strengthen their position within Europe. And so there is some nuance there that it would be very naive to think that you can have politics in isolation of each other. Even with the Brexit, you don't see that happening. So in that sense, I think there is criticism on some of the tendencies within the European Union, partly to blame by themselves, the position the EU took in the 1990s, early 2000s, was, tending towards a kind of state formation process, which then leads to these kind of national reflexes. I also think in general that the right-wing parties are more focal here because they have a clearer alternative for the situation. So Brexit is an example. The idea is nationalism. You break out of the European setting and you become Switzerland or Norway or nowadays Britain. So they have a more straightforward alternative than the left-wing parties, which makes it harder. In the case of a party like the Partij voor de Dieren, if you are opposing against bioindustries and et cetera, it's large-scale industries, which it's very difficult to mobilize a European agenda against that. And you are faced with industrial lobbies, agricultural lobbies, et cetera, which are well represented in Brussels. So I can understand their criticism. If you want to change these practices, it's not the easiest arena to start your fight, so to say.
A very good point here that they are not against cooperation, so they are doing more selective cooperation. So selective cooperation in a sense that trying to cooperate with each other that share same ideas or similar political agenda. And you mentioned 1990s and 2000. It's a very interesting period. Why specifically for our audience? Maybe they are not aware of those periods. Maybe you can give a particular example.
Yeah, well, the EU has a relatively short history. If you take its formation in 1991, 1992 with the Treaty of Maastricht, it's already interesting that at that time, when populations were asked their opinion about the treaty for the European Union, roughly 50% in many countries were against. And in Denmark, it even took two rounds to get the treaty accepted. And so that kind of skepticism where power moves from your national capitals to Brussels makes people fearful of the consequences, lack of democratic control, these kind of things. Nevertheless, the 1990s were the decade after the Cold War when many Central and East European countries were seeking membership of the European Union, which gave a lot of power to Europe, to the EU. It's interesting, for example, to look at the relations of the European Commission with Hungary nowadays and in the 1990s. When it was not yet a member of the EU, the demands were huge. We had the Copenhagen criteria, and so there was a lot of power. If you wanted to become a member, you had to implement all this legislation. You had to show that you're able to become a member. Once you're in, your position changes because then you're one of the voices among the others. And so in that sense, there is an interesting paradox that being critical of the EU is easier when you were part of it than when you're outside of it. And in the case of Hungary, you can clearly see this. And I wonder what this will mean for Britain in the near future, that you're still stuck with the EU, but you're no longer sitting at the table where the decisions are being made. So what's the advantage of going out? But it's partly to blame Brussels itself that it's, in my sense, overplayed its hand. It was too successful. It wanted the constitution, it had its flag, it wanted an army, it was turned into a kind of 19th century state formation process. And well, that made me skeptic, and probably some others as well.
Well, thank you very much, Jaap. So basically, we can say Brussels is too ambitious with its plans as well. Tom, do you want to ask a follow-up to Jaap or Jan? Or?
Yes, I have a follow-up question for Jaap. You mentioned that, you mentioned the collapse of the Soviet Union. Do you think that if there would be a threatening other, that your skepticism would then fall away a bit more?
Well, the Russians at the moment do their best to fulfill this role again, which is again also partly due to the EU itself. In this kind of quasi-state formation process, the federalization of Europe in the hands of the EU, it's quite obvious that the Russian Federation would never join. And as a consequence, we see a return of a kind of old-fashioned geopolitics where especially Ukraine and Georgia and nowadays also Belarus have become theaters for battles for spheres of influence, which I think is a poor development and partly to blame to the EU itself as well.
So how do you think that an actor like Russia or an actor like China could make use of Eurosceptic parties in order to influence the European Union?
Well, why would it be to their advantage? It depends again on what you look at. If in principle, it depends on the issue area where you're looking. As a trade partner, the EU is a very interesting partner for both Russia and China. And so it's only in these kind of more traditional geopolitical realms that this becomes problematic.
Could I say something about
yes,
this last point?
Go ahead.
It's very interesting, of course, if there's a link between Euroscepticism and Russia, for example. Of course, there are stories about Russia trying to finance Eurosceptic parties in Western Europe, particularly the Rassemblement National, and also the PVV has been, and the FPÖ in Austria have been blamed for receiving money from Russia. But this has been extremely unsuccessful, this way of trying, of by Russia trying to increase or to make more Euroscepticism was not very successful for many reasons, because the electorate is not very happy with the idea that Russia, that Putin could be financing these clubs. So it also sometimes leads to a loss of voters. It's interesting to make this difference between China and Russia, because where Russia indeed sometimes focuses on Eurosceptic parties, China is not interested at all in these Eurosceptic parties, but they focus on the states. They focus on the governments in Europe. And there they try to play the European countries off against each other. For example, we have this 17+1 framework where China is trying to create a division in Europe. But that's just on the government level and not on the political party level. So I think this link between Euroscepticism and authoritarian regimes is not very clear, at least not very successful so far.
So basically we can say for Russia, it's more like divide and rule within European parties. So left wing, right wing, center. But for China, it's more similarly divide and rule, but as a state level. One is doing it as a state level, another one is doing party level.
Yeah, but also Russia, I think, realizes that getting in contact with these Eurosceptic parties is not a very successful strategy. Their cyber criminal behavior is, of course, much more successful. So they focus on that. That's much more successful than getting in touch with Eurosceptic parties. So these Russian trolls and Russian hackers and their activities, they are a potential threat for Europe, much more, I think, than trying to create more Euroscepticism.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I also would like to know Jaap's opinion about the success of the Russian support for the European Eurosceptic parties. For example, recently I watched a Dutch program, VPRO, and they were investigating the connection between Forum for Democracy and the Russian connection. And the program made a very bold claims about this connection, especially the party leader. When I look at as a, let's say, outsider, I think there is a success. That Russia to some extent succeed to influence or at least create this kind of chaotic and increase the popularity of Eurosceptics. What is your stance on their success?
Depends a bit. We always get very nervous when there is finance coming from the outside, whereas we are financing organizations ourselves in other countries as well. And think of development cooperation and other fields. And so in principle, I'm not too much concerned about it. There is moreover a kind of circular situation, which I'd like to emphasize here, that for the more pro-democratic forces in Russia, it has become harder and harder to give voice to what they wanted to achieve in Russia itself, because when freedom and democracy become synonyms of EU membership, then it's obvious that you don't have much success in your domestic setting in Russia. So part of the more intellectual attractiveness of what Europe has to offer has been sidelined by all these association treaties and memberships, etc. And in the early 90s, this was still more open and more promising. We had with NATO a partnership for peace with Russia. And so during the 1990s, the frustration in Russia has increased enormously. And perhaps their skepticism comes from that period. And I hope that we have to wait for a new generation to see whether we can restore a kind of balance there between the European countries and Russia, which will remain your neighbor, whether you like it or not.
And it's interesting that you again refer back to the 1990s, but why not even back then from Soviet Union time? Isn't it not a traditional strategy that has been followed up after the 1990s? Why specifically 90s, not before?
Well, because of the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that's a major game changer, I would say. Although we are now more or less pushing the situation back in the same direction, which is a bit astonishing, actually, if you looked at the opportunities that were there. And so the 1990s were quite unique in opening all kind of options for positive change. And again, I think that the EU was too enthusiastic about its own success at that moment and overplayed its hand and helped to create the situation that we're now faced with. And by the way, during the Soviet time, there was always also a lot of concern about money coming from the East to the West, or influences or espionage, connections with the Stasi in East Germany, etc. It was all there, and of course, but it should not be exaggerated in its impact on countries.
Okay, that's very interesting, and I want to ask also Jan's opinion about that. Jan, what do you think? Can we go before 1990s, about this Euroscepticism history and its connection to outside powers, like, let's say, back then, Soviet Union? Or would you agree with Jaap also starting point, or at least game-changing point, 1990s? What's your position on that?
Yeah, I think the game-changing point is indeed the 1990s and the 2000s. Let's not forget the 2000s. The 9/11 tragedy, I think, had a major impact also on Europe, but also, of course, the introduction of the euro. Let's not underestimate this. The fact that the euro was introduced led to a lot of confusion in Europe, especially at a time that there were so-called budget rules were discussed between, or also agreed on between, member states, and these budget rules were ignored quite quickly after they were agreed upon. And that led to a lot of confusion in Europe and a lot of unrest under the population. So all these things contributed to the rise of Euroscepticism. Of course, before the end of the Cold War, there was also, of course, Russian infiltration or Soviet infiltration in Europe, also in the Netherlands. Think about the CPN, the Communist Party. But again, as Jaap said, it was not that influential, I think. May I say something in general about Euroscepticism? Because we tend to see it as a major problem. I think also you, in the questions you ask, it is seen as a threat and a problem for Europe. But I'm not so pessimistic about it, actually, in the sense that it's good that there is Euroscepticism. It's, in democratic terms, it's extremely important that it is there. I remember during the time of the Cold War, there was the so-called period of permissive consensus in Europe, which was a bit, you know, everybody more or less was in favor of having European integration, or at least people didn't voice their opinions about it. I think that was not a very healthy way of discussing the EC at that time, at the European Community and European integration. I think it's good that there are parties who voice criticism of the European Union. It keeps the European Union alert. It also prevents the European Union from taking measures which may be going too far. And if you look at the moment at how people view Europe and the EU, the results are quite positive, actually. So think about the whole Brexit tragedy, and that had led, paradoxically, to the European countries coming closer together. And I still think that Europe, the EU, is an important force in also in terms of reacting to authoritarian regimes. So being united, or, well, united is a bit of a too strong word for the EU, of course, but taking a joint stance towards Russia, towards China, towards Turkey, I think is very important. It's also perceived as very important by the states, and including Germany, the biggest state, sees that there are advantages in having this this cooperation. So I'm not too pessimistic, actually.
Okay, that's very interesting that you see more advantages rather than disadvantages. Tom, go ahead. I think you have a follow-up question.
Yeah, and I think you're right that all parties, of course, should be able to take their stance and to be critical on the European Union as well. But I think we shouldn't really be happy with possible influence from abroad, right? So if we assume that there's an influence from the Russians in Eurosceptic parties, how could we go against this? Should we have like a foreign agents law like in Russia, or how should we counter the assumed influence?
Well, as I said before, we shouldn't make this too much of a serious problem in the first place. I think we shouldn't exaggerate this problem. And at the same time, I mean, we should be alert. And that's what we are doing. The government is doing that, but also the parliament and the press. You referred, I think, to this VPRO program about the connection between Baudet and Russia. And this has also been the case with the FPÖ in Austria. There has been this scandal recently with its leader Strache. So there's a lot of check. There are a lot of checks and balances there, and I think, So I think that for the moment, at least, that is sufficient in countering this threat.
Okay, I want to follow up Jan's, let's say, opinion about this positive side of the Eurosceptics. So, Jaap, as an expert on security, would you consider Euroscepticism as a security issue, as a threat, or do you also share Jan's opinion that we shouldn't exaggerate it and we should rather see it as a wake-up call for the European elites than making it as a European security issue? What is your opinion on that?
Well, it's part of politics, and it's very, very interesting historically is that politics in Europe, first Western Europe, and since the 1990s, the whole of Europe is mainly focused on international organizations rather than military developments. And something like a Brexit in the 19th century would have been a small war, probably, and would have required the mobilization of armies, etc. And so in a historical longer time frame, it's quite unique that most of the conflicts are about membership, about positions within organizations, and that's, I think, good, including the skepticism that is part of it. And it has indeed a long tradition. And I was just thinking that there's something that we tend to forget, and it's hardly mentioned in our textbooks on European integration. But the first country that left the European integration process was Greenland in 1985. Well, it was less than 60,000 inhabitants, I think, but the country is huge. And if you look at textbooks, well, most of them deal with it in a footnote or something, not as something that is part of the process. But if you broaden that to countries who refuse to play ball with the European community, then like the Faroe Islands, Switzerland, Norway, Britain itself for a long time, actually, trying to set up alternatives. It's power politics, but it's power politics in terms of international organizations rather than in military terms. And so that's, in that sense, the skepticism has no security dimension, which might lead to violence or upheavals in that sense.
So basically, you said a very good and interesting argument that if it was in the 19th century, it would be a security issue, even from a traditional security perspective, and it would lead a conflict between maybe a continent and Britain or two countries. But in the 21st century, it is not.
No, if we'll look at the problems that some countries now experience with Hungary. Well, in the past, you would send your army to them to teach them a lesson and say, well, let's restore the order in the way that we want to have it. Well, that is really an anachronism. We don't do that anymore. It's not even on the horizon. And perhaps that also explains why there is so much freedom, actually, for governments to choose their own policies and their alternative routes within Europe. And so in that sense, it's gain. It's a bit of a pity that we don't invest more in other European organizations. Jan already mentioned the Council of Europe with its human rights agenda. Well, it hardly has a budget to do its job. But it includes Turkey, it includes Russia, it includes all these other countries. And we are simply ignoring the opportunities that organizations like that could give if we simply triple their budgets and personnel and expertise, etc. But the focus on the EU only is part of the poverty of European politics at the moment. And NATO is sometimes mentioned, but it's also often neglected in this context. But so we should broaden that scope, and then I'm sure that we can create much more cooperative frameworks in which we, well, Jan said, united in diversity is the slogan of the EU, and rightly so.
I have a follow-up question on this, because you mentioned the geopolitical aspect. We do hear also more often from, I believe, from the European Commission as well, that the EU is actually orienting itself more towards becoming a geopolitical actor, right? So how would you see that developing, Jaap?
Well, there is a strong tendency already for a long time that there are two difficulties with integration logics. And one is that there's a tendency to say we will only be successful if we become a federation. So which is denying the actual success of the European Union at the moment. It's a huge trading bloc, and it provides security for a lot of people. But if you want to play the traditional great power game, yes, then of course it's not fit to do that in a traditional way. So there is a tendency among people who are concerned about European security that as long as we are not stand united, then we are lost, which is simply, simply hard to prove that this is the situation. Look at how both the US and now China exert their power in Europe. That's in a different way. And the second thing is that in integration theory, it has the same logic as economic theory, that it's about growth, growth, and growth. So if we don't have more integration tomorrow, apparently Europe is sick, and we need to do something about it. And that's an axiom that you should not automatically accept. The thing is, how do you make an alternative? How can you say, well, okay, we have achieved something. This is good. Let's stabilize it and be happy with the present results.
Okay, that's very interesting. And Jan, do you have an additional comment on this before we wrap up our also podcast?
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, Europe has been strong not as a geopolitical force in the traditional sense of the word, but Europe is extremely successful with its regulatory powers. So in terms of economics, trade, finance, etc., Europe rules the world, you could say. There's this very interesting book by Anu Bradford, The Brussels Effect, where she describes how important Europe is in describing the rules to the rest and prescribing the rules of the rest to the world, and the rest of the world has to follow on a lot of issues. That's where the power of Europe is, and we shouldn't underestimate it, I think.
That's a normative power then?
Not really a normative power only. I think it's a regulatory power, which is a bit different. I think it's the rules. It's not particularly the norms, but it's the rules with which Europe wants to be powerful in the world and is successful, I think, also there.
So in conclusion, we can summarize today's discussion that Euroscepticism actually is kind of a wake-up call for maybe European political elites to fix their certain ambitious or confusion plans in terms of the future of Europe. And well, the history of Eurosceptics, especially a key point starting from 1990s and 2000, and it is not a security threat, or we shouldn't exaggerate it as a security threat for the European integration as well. Well, this was very interesting. Jaap, Jan, thank you very much for joining us today, and it was really fruitful conversation.